Welcome to Most Holy Family Monastery's fourth radio program. On this program, we are going to take some email questions. We're going to answer some email questions. We can take some phone calls if people wish to call us at 1-800-275-1126. And we wanted to start off, a lot of people call us and they ask, you know, what diocese are you in? Who's your bishop? And just recently, the bishop, so-called Catholic bishop of Buffalo, took part in an interreligious prayer meeting with the Dalai Lama, other false religions. The Dalai Lama actually vested the bishop, gave him some vestment put around his head. There's prayers, joint prayers going on, other kinds of stuff like this, interreligious, you know, activity that's all totally condemned by the Catholic Church, total religious indifferentism. This guy is clearly an apostate. And so this is actually the so-called Catholic bishop of the Novus Ordo Church that a lot of people would like to see us be under. And so, and a lot of people say, you know, these guys are the legitimate bishops, though, aren't they? They're in the churches of God. And it sort of makes you think back to the Bible where St. Paul talks about the man of sin will sit in the temple of God. So we know that it's predicted that the man of sin himself will appear to sit in the temple of God. So when these people say, well, they're sitting in the temple of God, we know that it's predicted at the end of the world that God will allow Satan himself and his enemies to seemingly occupy what are the buildings, what were the buildings of the Catholic Church, will be occupied and seemingly controlled on some level by his enemies that will actually not be Catholics, but will actually try to persecute the true faith and be heretics. And we have other examples of other bishops engaging in this kind of activity all over the world.
And there's some interesting features of this particular ecumenical event. It was actually the one of the most massive interreligious prayer meetings that ever took place in New York. There were 6,000 people there. You had a Baptist preacher, a Jewish rabbi, a Muslim imam, the Dalai Lama, as he mentioned, all reciting prayers and performing various acts according to their various false religions. And I think it's important to quote once again what Pope Pius XI says about this kind of activity, because in 1928 he, you know, published his encyclical Mortalium Animos on this kind of thing, and he explicitly addresses certain endeavors to hold meetings and addresses which are arranged by these persons, at which a large number of listeners are present, and at which all without distinction are invited to join in the discussion, both infidels of every kind and Christians. So exactly what we saw here at this ecumenical event, infidels of every kind, such as Muslims, the Buddhist, Dalai Lama, and so-called Christians, the Baptist preacher, etc., even those who have unhappily fallen away from Christ or who with obstinacy and pertinacity deny his divine nature and mission, in other words, the Jews, and the Jewish rabbi was at this event as well, certainly such attempts can nowise be approved by Catholics, founded as they are on that false opinion which considers all religions to be more or less good and praiseworthy, since they all in different ways manifest and signify that sense which is inborn in us all. So he's saying this kind of activity is founded on the false opinion that all religions are more or less good and praiseworthy. That's exactly what it means, and that's exactly the message that is being delivered to anyone who sees this kind of event. And he says not only are those who hold this opinion in error, so it's not just an error, but also in distorting the idea of true religion, they reject it, and little by little turn aside to naturalism and atheism, it is called, from which it follows that one who supports those who hold these theories and attempt to realize them is altogether abandoning the divinely revealed religion. So this kind of activity is completely condemned by Pope Pius XI as a rejection of the true religion, as apostasy from the Catholic faith. And as we've pointed out in our writings, here's what St. Robert Bellarmine says about heretics. Finally, the Holy Fathers teach unanimously not only that heretics are outside the church, but also that they are ipso facto deprived of all ecclesiastical jurisdiction and dignity. So this so-called Bishop of Buffalo, Bishop Edward U. Kmimek, is completely condemned by Catholic teaching. He's outside the Catholic Church. He holds no authority in the church.
Okay.
We're going to take a call first.
Hello. Hi, this is Richard. My question is about what's the proper interpretation of Council of Trent's talk about baptism desire? Prior to that, it was very clear baptism by water alone. What's the proper interpretation of Trent?
Are you referring to a specific part of Trent?
I just heard people say that the Council of Trent at some point, it's alleged that it talks about the possibility, the plausibility of baptism of desire.
Well,
but to that point, it doesn't really appear anywhere.
Okay. We covered this in our last program. It's covered in our book. The simple answer is that there's nothing in Trent which teaches baptism of desire.
Okay.
There's one passage, Session 6, Chapter 4, on justification, which the baptism of desire advocates try to quote. But actually, when you examine that passage, you see that it doesn't teach baptism of desire. It actually says that justification cannot take place without the laver of regeneration or a desire for it, as it is written, unless a man is born again of water and the Holy Ghost, he cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. So it doesn't say that justification can take place by the laver of regeneration or the desire for it. It says it cannot take place without the laver of regeneration or the desire for it, as it is written, affirming that the words of our Lord Jesus Christ are to be understood as it is written. And so some have misread that and thought it was saying that it could happen by either one, but it doesn't say that. And when you examine the full context of the passage where it's reaffirming that John 3:5 is to be taken as it is written, and all the other statements on baptism in Trent, all affirm that the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 3:5 are literal. The canons on baptism had every opportunity to define the so-called three baptisms, or to define that you can be saved by baptism of desire, or to mention baptism of blood. Didn't mention it at all. You had, I think, 16 chapters in the decree on justification. It could have clearly been mentioned that you can be justified before the sacrament is received. It's not mentioned anywhere.
Okay, next question.
Okay.
When the marital act has a low probability of bringing forth children, but you're open to it, not only open to it, you primarily desire it, that it's your desire to have children, but you're cognizant of the fact that it's a low probability, would the act be licit or illicit?
Well, simply put, as we point out in our article on natural family planning on the website, that the sin in natural family planning comes in when people take positive steps to try to avoid having children.
Okay.
So if they're not taking any positive steps to try to avoid having children,
okay,
then they're not doing anything wrong.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
and just going back to that Council of Trent question, that section also is talking about the justification of the impie, the impious, which for those above the age of reason, they have to desire to receive the sacrament of baptism, as the Catechism of the Council of Trent points out. So, okay.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Thanks.
Going back to this apostasy of the so-called bishop in Buffalo, I think it's important to quote a passage from Dom Prosper Guéranger in the Liturgical Year. That's a 15-volume set on the liturgy that a lot of people are familiar with. And he's talking about the heresy of Nestorius, which we mentioned in past programs. And he's talking about how the layman reacted and the people reacted when this occurred, the heresy being, you know, propagated by their bishop. And I think it's worth quoting the passage because we haven't done that on any program yet. And he writes in Volume 4, page 379, "It was then that Satan produced Nestorius, enthroned in the chair of Constantinople." So he's talking about Nestorius as the bishop of Constantinople. And he says, "On Christmas Day 428, he pronounced from the episcopal pulpit the blasphemous words, 'Mary did not bring forth God, her son was only a man, the instrument of the divinity.' The multitude shuddered with horror. Eusebius, a simple layman, rose to give expression to the general indignation and protested against this impiety." Okay, so a layman was the one who opposed it. And he says, "Soon a more explicit protest was drawn up and disseminated in the name of the members of the church." So the members of the church drew up a protest, launching an anathema, says Dom Prosper Guéranger, against anyone who would dare to say the only begotten Son of the Father and the Son of Mary are different persons. This generous attitude, whereby they anathematized their bishop for promoting heresy, when in reality what they did was acknowledge that he was already anathematized, he says, won the praise of popes and councils, And he says, when the shepherd becomes a wolf, the first duty of the flock is to defend itself. So he's pointing out that it's the tradition of the church, praised by popes and councils, when you're presented with a heretical bishop, that you resist it and actually recognize that that bishop is anathematized. And they actually chanted, an emperor we have, but no bishop, recognizing that they don't have a bishop because their bishop defected into heresy.
And that's why these saints like St. Robert Bellarmine will say that someone who's a manifest heretic automatically loses all jurisdictional authority. He may claim to sit there and be the authority, but if he's a manifest heretic, he ceases to have any authority.
And this was confirmed by Pope St. Celestine. St. Robert Bellarmine quotes this passage when he's discussing the loss of office, manifest heretics, and he says, the authority of our apostolic see is determined that the simple Christian or cleric who had been deposed or excommunicated by Nestorius after he began to preach heresy shall not be considered deposed or excommunicated. For he who had defected from the faith with such preachings cannot depose or remove anyone whatsoever. So you have the Pope confirming that Nestorius had no authority after he defected into heresy, confirming that heretics lose their offices. And the reason we mention this in detail is because this, of course, applies directly to the apostate bishop in Buffalo. He can claim to be the bishop of Buffalo all he wants. He's outside the church. He's a religious indifferentist. He believes in salvation outside the church. He believes in the false ecumenical apostasy condemned by Mortalium Animus and a host of other heresies.
Yeah, that we shouldn't convert non-Catholics to the Catholic faith. He believes that there is not just one true Christian church, the Catholic Church. He believes everyone who would claim to be a Christian, the Methodist, the Baptist, the Lutheran, the Anglican, that they are all Christians, and all their false so-called Christian sects are also part of the Christian Church, as is taught by Vatican II, that the Church of Christ is something bigger than the Catholic Church.
And what we're seeing here in Buffalo, we're just mentioning this because we're located in the Diocese of Buffalo, and that proves that he's not part of the Catholic Church, this recent event. This applies all over the world to the Novus Ordo bishops, and of course to the so-called Bishop of Rome, Antipope Benedict XVI and John Paul II, etc., because what he's doing is simply implementing what they have taught and done themselves. And so this applies at the local level and, of course, at the other levels of the false church.
And some people may have seen last week that John Paul II taught that saints come from all the different churches. And, you know, we had the quote from Pope Pius XI, where Pope Pius XI points out that the church, and she alone, produces saints. So you can see that these are two opposite teachings. One pope is the Pope Pius, the real pope, Pope Pius XI, is teaching that the Catholic Church alone produces saints. And the anti-pope, the false claimant to the papacy, is teaching that saints come from all the different churches. And he specifically names them. He says that John Paul II said that they come from the Anglican, you know, the so-called Orthodox churches, you know, all these different sects.
This is one of the most overlooked heresies because besides our group, I'm not sure of any other group that even mentions this one, even though it's repeated again and again, this heresy that there are saints in other religions. The commemoration of the new martyrs in the 2000. But this quote was particularly interesting, this Pope Pius XI quote, because it basically word for word contradicts what John Paul II said in Ut Unum Sint. And so it's just devastating to anyone who would defend these guys from the charge of heresy. And in the same encyclical, it mentions that saints are models, as we covered in this Heresy of the Week, which is very important to understand because, as we pointed out, we're headed towards a situation where the counterchurch will soon, quote, canonize people like Mother Teresa, who loved all religions, who said she just wants to make members of false religions better members of false religions. They're headed for, quote, sainthood in the false church. And so the way that these groups, such as the Society of St. Pius X, other independent groups, who, you know, resist the Vatican to apostasy in a certain way, but still hold on to the anti-popes as true popes, the way they're going to try to justify and explain all this away is that, well, they may have converted at the end and you know, we just don't know. They could be in heaven. Well, that is blown away by an understanding of what a saint is. A canonized saint is a model, Okay, and so you could never, the church could never raise up for veneration a saint who didn't model a dedication to the Catholic faith, but modeled a dedication to universal apostasy and indifferentism. And so basically when this occurs, when this, quote, canonization of John Paul II or Mother Teresa, and even when it occurred with Jose Maria Escriva, it will be a, quote, canonization of apostasy by the Vatican II sect. And it will be total proof, in addition to all the proof we already have, that these guys can't be true popes. Another thing we wanted to cover was Benedict XVI's recent situation with the Muslims, where, as I'm sure almost everyone has heard, he, in a speech on September 12, 2006, he quoted a statement from a medieval emperor who said, quote, "Show me just what Muhammad brought that was new, and there you will find things only evil and inhuman, such as his command to spread the sword by the faith he preached." And this, of course, caused an incredible stir in the Muslim world and, you know, really angered them. And many people were shocked that he would say this because it seemed to be a denunciation of Islam. And they said, well, maybe this shows that he has a dedication to the faith, that he really is a believer, that he's really against Islam. And we, of course, warn people that no, it doesn't mean that, that he will make some conservative statements here or there because his role, since the apostasy is so well in place right now, that his role is to try to neutralize the conservative elements. So he will continue to preach his heresies, continue to preach his apostasy, but he's going to do some deceiving gestures.
The devil is after the people who really claim to be traditional Catholics. I mean, because he's got everybody else, clearly. So basically, he's after these people, the people who actually are sort of clinging to some traditions of the Catholic Church, to make sure that they, you know, go to hell. That's what he wants. He wants to deceive them. And so that's the whole reason he threw out this statement, to make it appear as if he's a conservative. So the people say, well, he is a true pope because, look, he made a conservative statement like this. But it actually backfired on him.
Yeah, and we saw the truth come out. It's really interesting because we got a call from a guy from Texas who is a strong Catholic, and he was battling with his wife over these issues. And he's trying to convince his wife of what's going on, and his wife referenced this statement he made against Islam and their angry reaction with him to try to prove, no, look, he is a good man, he is a true pope. And this man from Texas said to his wife, no, he just said that to make you believe he was a true pope when he's a false pope. And he was exactly right, of course, because we saw just a few days later that Benedict XVI apologizes for his statement and says, these, in fact, were a quotation from a medieval text which do not in any way express my personal thought.
That's just amazing.
That's just, people really need to think about that, that the, what the significance of that is.
Yeah, why would he say something like that, you know, if he didn't believe it?
Yeah, he clearly endorsed this statement. Right after quoting the statement I read you, he says, the emperor, after having expressed himself so forcefully, goes on to explain in detail the reasons why spreading the faith through violence is something unreasonable. Violence is incompatible with the nature of God and the nature of the soul. So he's clearly agreeing, okay, with the statement of the emperor and clearly presenting this as something that's true and his own beliefs. And so he says that later on, they do not in any way express his personal thought. That absolutely proves he's a liar.
Yeah, and he actually had a perfect opportunity, if he were a real Catholic, which he isn't, when they started to burn these churches, these Muslims, in reaction to his statement. Actually, it proved that the quote that he had read was absolutely accurate. And so he had a perfect opportunity to say, well, see what they're doing now? They're using violence to try to promote their religion and burning down churches. But no, since he's of the devil, he apologizes and says it doesn't reflect his personal belief at all.
And what's really interesting is let's say we believe this. Let's say we believe his apology here where he says, these, in fact, were a quotation from a medieval text which do not in any way express my personal thought. Okay, let's say we accept that. Then what does that mean about his September 12th speech where he's quoting this and clearly presenting this as his opinion? That proves that that was just to give a false impression, in order to try to deceive traditionalists. It absolutely proves that. And what's interesting is we see this elsewhere in his writings. For instance, in his book Principles of Catholic Theology, which is just filled with amazing heresies, he talks about, in other of his books, he talks about, you know, how much he likes the old liturgy and how upset he is that, you know, certain bishops, you know, are opposed to the old liturgy but not opposed to liturgical abuses. So he seems to be, like, traditional in that area. But meanwhile, he says that the validity of liturgy does not depend on words of consecration, but on the community. So he doesn't even believe in the Catholic concept of a valid Mass at all. That's why he says you can go to Masses which have no words of consecration. And yet he's, you know, feigning this devotion to the traditional liturgy in these other books.
Yeah, he's saying you can go to a schismatic liturgy, I mean, which is horrible enough. I mean, that's totally evil and heretical. And as you can go to a schismatic liturgy, and you can go to a schismatic liturgy that has no words of consecration. So it's all part of an act. It actually makes you think back, actually, it was pointed out about John Paul II. During one of his trips, they actually prepared a spot where John Paul II would break away from the crowd and pick up a child. Way ahead of time, the whole thing was set up. And it was pointed out by someone who wrote a book on John Paul II. So a lot of this stuff is done to deceive you, to make it look like they're conservative, they're traditional, they care about people, you know, they love people, they seem so nice. That's how the devil deceives people. He comes as an angel of light.
Especially in this time when we're living in the darkest era, really, spiritually, of the whole history of the church. And, you know, people need to realize a lot of the problem is a lot of people don't really believe that guys could be this evil or this much under the power of the devil. And what's interesting, I think it's worth looking at another heresy of Ratzinger to show how evil he actually is and what his real intentions are. In his book Principles of Catholic Theology, he actually makes an interesting statement. He says on page 184, he says, "From what has been said, it is clear that all Christian theology, if it is to be true to its origin, must be first and foremost a theology of resurrection." Okay, he says that. Oh, and he goes on, he says, "It must be a theology of resurrection before it is a theology of the metaphysical sonship of God." Well, why would he say that all Christian theology, if it is to be true to its origin, must be a theology of the resurrection? All dogmas don't come from the resurrection. Okay, it's true, if you deny the resurrection, it's basically to deny the whole faith. But, like, for instance, the apostles believed that Jesus was the Son of God before his resurrection. Why does he want to wrap so much up into the resurrection? Why does he want to say that the origin of all dogmas is in the resurrection? Why? I didn't know why until I got to page 186 of his book when I was reading this some time back. He says, quote, on page 186, "Thus the resurrection cannot be a historical event in the same sense as the crucifixion is." Well, now we see why he wanted to wrap everything up into the resurrection, because he goes on to deny that the resurrection is even a historical event in the same sense as the crucifixion. So therefore, if the resurrection is the origin of all dogmas, and the resurrection isn't really historical, that means that none of the teachings of the church are really historical and really true. They're all based on this fiction, this experience, okay, what the modernists talk about, of the resurrection. And so I found that interesting. And he actually goes on to explain that, and he says, in page 184, "The sentence 'Jesus has risen' thus expresses that primitive experience on which all Christian faith is grounded." And this is exactly what Pius X condemned about modernists. He says, "By the modernists, tradition is understood as a communication to others through preaching by means of the intellectual formula of an original experience." What Pius X says is that the modernists, you know, that someone has this experience. It's not really a true teaching. It's just an experience someone has. And then all the whole religion is based on this. And that's exactly what Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, is saying about the resurrection and basically the whole Christian faith.
And actually, going back to the quote where he said that the statements he made or quoted about Islam reflect in no way his personal opinion. It's just absolutely amazing. People need to realize the significance of what he's saying.
But yeah, and even like certain, we were just reading an article in the newspaper from a secular author. He's saying that if he didn't believe this stuff, why would he have made these words his own in this speech? You know, why? He's now saying that these words don't in any way express his thought. Well, why in the world would he have quoted them in this fashion in the speech?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally illogical.
Yeah, and it's just, it's extremely revealing, and people shouldn't miss the significance. And related to this is, I mean, he's praised Islam. Like in his book, Truth and Tolerance, he says, yet even Islam, with all the greatness it represents, this is page 204, with all the greatness it represents, Islam, it represents the rejection of the Trinity, it represents darkness, represents the persecution of the Christian world, and he's saying it represents greatness.
Yeah, not too long ago, he was meeting with an Islamic group, and he's talking about how the people who are teachers of Islam have, you know, such a great, you know, responsibility for the formation of younger generations in Islam. It's just apostasy.
And I think it's worth talking about some of the heresies in this book, Truth and Tolerance, because I don't think we've discussed them at all, because they're quite revealing. And this book was written by Benedict XVI in 2003, so not long ago. In this book, it's really interesting. He gets into how what his views are on other religions. And he says that there was a man named Ernst Troeltz who formulated a philosophy according to which Christianity should withdraw from its claim of universality, meaning the universal one true religion to which all must belong. And he says that Christianity should simply admit that it's just the side of God's face that is turned toward Europe, and that, you know, these other religions are the side of God's face that have turned to other parts of the world. That's what this guy, Troeltz, is saying. That, of course, would deny that Jesus Christ is the true God. It would say that these other gods are on a par with our Lord. It would be utter apostasy, of course, that Christianity is not the one true religion. Well, here's what he says about this idea. Has the claim of Christ—this is Ratzinger, Truth and Tolerance, pages 176, 177. 2004, it was republished, so not long ago. Has the claim of Christianity to be the true religion, then, been overtaken by the progress of enlightenment? Is it bound to step down from its claim and take its place in the Neoplatonic or Buddhist or Hindu view of truth and symbol? To content itself, as Troeltz suggested, with showing the side of God's face that is turned toward the Europeans? This is the real question that the church and theology have to ask themselves. No one will expect this question, which is making such fundamental demands on us, to be answered here in any way conclusively. So he's saying that this is a legitimate question, whether we should acknowledge that Christianity is not the universally true religion, and that God really has revealed these other religions in different parts of the world. He's saying that this is a legitimate question to be considered, and he's not going to answer it in this book. What people need, this is apostasy, of course. People need to remember that heresy is not only a denial of a dogma, but also a doubt. So, for instance, if you say that Christianity, you don't have to say, in order to be an apostate or a heretic, Christianity is not the true religion. You could just say Christianity might not be the true religion. You're an apostate. And that's exactly what he's saying in this book. And he's saying that his whole book doesn't even provide an answer to this question. There's some other interesting heresies in this book, bold heresies. And again, this is just a few years ago, this book was published by him. On page 207 of Truth and Tolerance, he says, the fact that in every age there have been and still are pagan saints is because everywhere and in every age, the speech of the heart can be heard. Pagan saints. Well, Pope Eugene IV infallibly defined that all the Jews, all the pagans, all the schismatics, all who die outside the church are lost. So, Denzinger 714. This is explicitly rejected right here in this book. Ratzinger, another quote from this book, page 205. He says, that means that salvation does not lie in religions as such, but it is connected to them. So, salvation is connected to religions in the plural, not just the true religion. This is, of course, bold heresy. We've covered that in detail. I'll just quote Gregory XVI. These misguided people attempt to persuade themselves and others that men are not saved only in the Catholic religion, but but that even heretics may attain eternal life. On page 44 of this same book, he talks about the controversy between religions. And he says, he discusses the place of the Christian faith and practice in the history of religions as a whole. He says, we are all, speaking of religions, part of a single history that is in many different fashions on the way toward God. So all the religions are on a way toward God. This is apostasy. He goes on to say, the Christian holds the history of religions to be a genuine history, to be a path whose direction we call progress. So, in other words, that implies, if it doesn't say so explicitly, that their histories are true, that their religions are true. But the second most interesting part of this book comes here on page 80, where he really discusses in detail his position. And he says, following these reflections on the relations between religion, faith, and culture, we can again take up the classification of possible solutions to the problem of religion. So he's talking about his solution to the problem of religions. And he says, which we met before in the three concepts of exclusivism, inclusivism, and pluralism. So he's saying it's one of these three positions. Probably no one today takes the possibility of exclusivism in the sense of denying salvation to all non-Christians. Well, of course, that is the dogma of the church. He's saying that's exclusivism and no one takes that position. So he's directly denying the true position there. He goes, essentially then, in response to the question of the relation between the Christian faith and the religions of the world, there remain the two possible solutions of inclusivism and pluralism. So he's limited his answer to either inclusivism or pluralism as his view toward other religions. And he explains what they are. He says, page 51, Karl Rahner, is reckoned to be the classical advocate of inclusivism, that Christianity is present in all religions. That's inclusivism, that Christianity is present in all religions. Okay, universal apostasy here. He says that's what inclusivism means. He goes, people in the pluralist position, page 52, are of the opinion that the plurality of religions is God's own will, and that all of them are paths to salvation. There are here, as with the so-called inclusivist position, many variations, so that here and there the two positions seem almost to merge into one another. So there's not much difference between the two. In the book, he never says which position is his, but he's clearly saying that it's one of the two, because he says he rules out exclusivism, and he says, on page 80, there remain the two possible solutions of inclusivism and pluralism. Therefore, no matter whatever it is, whether it's pluralism or inclusivism, it's apostasy.
And that's why, and also in his writings, I don't know if I've ever seen once so far, as during his reign as antipope, him mention the word hell or eternal damnation. I mean, this is, you know, pretty interesting. They don't want you to think about hell. They don't want you to know about hell. They don't want you to think that there's any possibility of a person going to hell, so that you go to hell.
And also, when you think about it, the Novus Ordo bishops stand for nothing. They don't excommunicate pro-abortionists. They don't excommunicate those in remarriage. They don't refuse communion to mortal sinners. They don't preach against anything. They're utter apostates. Have any of them even stood for any of the moral issues? Like, for instance, these horrible shows that are on mainstream television, like some of them, you know, even denounced any of them? No, they don't say anything. I mean, they're good for nothing except for basically paying out sex abuse settlements and attacking traditional Catholicism. That's really what it comes down to. One of the other things we were going to discuss are the people who see some of this stuff and they continually call it a counter-church, and they talk about, like, there's these different, what we call false traditionalists, people who recognize to one degree or another that, you know, Vatican II is teaching heresy and they oppose it, and they even call it a counterfeit church. And, like, for instance, we recently heard a talk by this woman named Cornelia Ferrara, who's constantly talking about the counter-church and the syncretism and the official heresies promoted by the Catholic Church. And it's really actually a blasphemy that these people continue to assert that the Vatican II sect is the Catholic Church. Year after year, okay, after they've seen all this, they continue to attack its official teachings. They quote all this heresy, all this apostasy. It's a new religion. Okay, it's a counter-church. And they never figure out that it's not the Catholic Church and that the Catholic Church cannot be apostate.
Yeah, it's just to make a mockery out of the Catholic Church. That's what it is.
Yeah. And in issue after issue of their publication, okay, their talks, it's just the same stuff. Yeah,
every year it's the same thing, and this heresy's, you know, and the John Paul II promoted this heresy, Benedict XVI's promoting this kind of heresy or this kind of scandal. There's scandal here, there's scandal there, there's scandal everywhere.
And they never get the point. And it just becomes foolishness because they basically, you know, they're just blaspheming the church they claim to defend.
It's really sick, actually, when you think about it.
And we're talking about the people who have seen the evidence for the Sede of Acontes position, you know, for significant periods of time. They've had a chance to review it, and they reject it, and they maintain their schismatic position. And it's really disgusting.
And also, these people will never tell you that any of these people are formal heretics. You will not hear that. And so when they say that, you know, we heard someone talking about how it's not that easy, you know, just to say this guy's a heretic and he's lost his office. Well, they don't say anyone's a heretic. I mean, you could be really pro-abortion. You could be for anything. As long as you, I guess, claim to be Catholic, you're part of the church, according to them. So at no point do they ever say that this guy is a heretic and he's lost his office. They will never say that. They actually believe that you're always a Catholic no matter what you do. And that's something people really need to realize when they hear these talks about how we can't judge these people as not being Catholics. Their position is to say that everybody's a Catholic no matter what they do, and that's why you'll never see them say about anybody that they're a heretic.
Yeah, because they enjoy their schismatic position whereby they can, you know, claim to have a visible pope and then reject his false church.
And also, as one person, his name's not important, he was giving a talk on Sede of Acontism, was saying that, you know, we do the same things. You know, we didn't have to make a judgment call about whether these bishops are really Catholics or not. We do the same things. We have the same mass. We follow the same traditional teachings. Well, you're acting as a Sede of Acontis without admitting it. You're saying that we don't listen to anything that they say. It's basically as if they don't exist. What's the difference? The only difference is that we're correctly pointing out that these guys aren't Catholics, and that's why you're not listening to any of their teachings. That's why you're not following any of the things that they're doing. That's why you're resisting everything that they're doing. That's why when an encyclical comes out from the man who they claim to be the Pope, they basically critique it and point out all the errors and novelties and, you know, how ridiculous it is and sort of almost laugh at it.
And what's interesting is there was recently an article written about, like, by one of these types of people who against the Cardinal Siri thesis, saying that, you know, we don't believe this, you know, because Cardinal Siri, that he was elected Pope in 1958 or 1963 because he acknowledged the post-Vatican II, quote, popes as true popes, which is true. Before I get to that, I just want to point out that one of the false traditionalist websites which linked to this article said more on the Cardinal Siri theory, silliness. Okay, referring to it as silliness. No, what's silliness and absurdity is the idea of John Paul II being canonized, which is where you're headed, or Mother Teresa, or a quote, Pope of the Catholic Church making new martyrs out of Protestant heretics. That's silliness and absurdity.
Or a Catholic Pope making the statement, may St. John the Baptist protect Islam, as John Paul II did on March 21st, 2000, and saying it's not heresy.
So they sort of like to try to attack and poke fun in their own ways, and they don't realize that they're actually the ones who are engaging in absurdity. But regarding this, we've pointed out that the information regarding Cardinal Siri's election in 1958 and 1963, which even Malachi Martin said he received the required number of votes to make him pope in the 1963 conclave, and that he was pressured into not accepting the election. What it's valuable in showing is that there was something uncanonical going on in the 1958-1963 conclaves. It's not valuable, and we've never asserted that Cardinal Siri remained the pope, okay, throughout all of the years which followed. And the fact he probably was in a state of confusion where, you know, he didn't know what his status was, probably. It's speculation, but
yeah, he may have thought that, you know, I don't know if I should go out there because, you know, maybe it sort of has to be more unanimous, or and apparently they say that Siri asked for another vote, you know, to see if this was really the will of God that he be Pope, you know, that they all vote again, you know, so he could sort of maybe confirm it in his own mind that, you know, he should just, you know, move forward and go out there, and that he was definitely the Pope. You know, it's such an amazing series of events. All this confusion and, you know, them trying to put down his election and cardinals maybe saying that they wouldn't accept him as Pope, that, you know, he felt like it was too big of a move to, you know, move forward and go out there and claim to be Pope, especially if there are also, as we have heard, threats on his life or his family's life and all kinds of other threats, that he felt that maybe it was a safer decision in his own mind to sort of make sure that it was really the will of God by having everyone vote again. But you have the evidence from Malachi Martin. You have U.S. State Department documents that seem to corroborate this information of him being elected. You have other authors. You have other people that seem to give you know, indications to intimate and seem to state clearly in certain ways that there was some confusion or Siri was elected.
Yeah, and so... but the fact that he did seem to accept the anti-popes later on would rule out the idea that he remained the Pope the whole time. But we don't need any of this Siri stuff to prove our point at all. It's all interesting extra information. The heresies of the Vatican II sect prove the point by themselves. And that's why we focus on those, because they're so devastating to anyone who would claim to defend the Vatican II anti-popes.
Also, for example, those who get the Fatima Crusader, who devoted, I was, one or two different issues against Sede Vacantism, just recently they put out another issue of issue 83. Some people may have received it, where they're attacking EWTN left and right, all kinds of articles attacking EWTN, the network gone wrong, promoting the book. You know, on and on and on about the novelties and all these crazy things that are being promoted on EWTN, interreligious prayer meetings or promotion of religious indifferentism. But yet, he didn't condemn John Paul II as a heretic. In fact, over and over again, he talks about priests, bishops, and cardinals. I'm talking about Nicholas Gruner, that are leading people sort of away from the faith, that you have to be careful of them. But rarely does he mention the man who he claims to be Pope. I mean, this is just pure dishonesty. And there's nothing devoted to any of these heresies of Ratzinger. There's nothing devoted to John Paul II's interreligious prayer meetings. He devoted a whole campaign to stop the Hindu takeover of the shrine over in Fatima and the prayer meeting that they had. Well, where was this guy getting this idea from? The meetings that John Paul II held, the Assisi prayer meetings, his encyclicals, his writings, this was all coming from the man who claims to be Pope. And so the fact that a person would attack other groups or priests or bishops or even cardinals of the Novus Ordo Church, but wouldn't directly attack the main source of the problem, is just a liar. And it's just, it's totally evil, because it's keeping the people away from the truth. In fact, actually, a couple of issues ago, some people may remember, basically he promoted John Paul II, a speech that he gave, maybe it was in Fatima, where talking about how John Paul II is trying to give you the real key to understanding the third secret, that of the bishops and cardinals and priests that will lead you away from the faith. I mean, how can a person like Nicholas Gruner, who has knowledge of what John Paul II did, of what Benedict XVI did, I believe in his book a few years ago, he accused Ratzinger of being a liar.
Before Ratzinger was elected, he attacked him, or in the book he endorsed, which was compiled by Paul Leonard Kramer, The Devil's Final Battle, that attacks Ratzinger, probably because they didn't realize that he would be elected. And so once he's elected, you know, they have to basically keep quiet pretty much. And
that tells you whether a person really stands for the truth. It's something you tell the truth no matter what the price is. You don't lie to the people. You don't just attack other guys that are doing it. You attack everybody that's engaging in the heresy. Heretics don't do that. Liars don't do that, though. And so that's the point, that you're not getting the full truth from him on what's going on. Even though he has some, you know, good things, even in this issue, that can be very deceptive, so that people think, well, he has, you know, some good stuff in here, which he actually does have some good stuff, but it's mixed in with false conclusions and other heresies and lies.
And he's quoted John Paul II so much that I can even basically memorize some of his. He quotes, "Can the mother, with all the force of love, can she remain silent?" That quote, basically, you know, just promoting John Paul II over and over again. It's just really disgusting.
It really, pictures of him all over the place. You know what I mean? It's just, and then also the false understanding of really what the,
oh, yeah,
the Fatima is all about. And I think that we should discuss really, you know.
Well, yeah,
maybe quickly.
Yeah, we can in more detail, possibly in a future program. But basically, when the phony third secret was released and they announced that it would be released, that they would release the, quote, the real third secret finally, we were somewhat excited because, you know, this would force a lot of people to take a stand. We knew that they wouldn't reveal the real third secret. And so all these groups, these false traditional groups like the SSPX and these other groups and Gruner, they would be forced to make a decision. Would they accept the false third secret that would be revealed, or, and therefore deny, you know, what they know the third secret really contains, something about the apostasy? Or would they reject the phony third secret and call John Paul II a liar of the worst sort for foisting upon the world a counterfeit secret? So we were really looking, it was sort of like a crossroads here. What would they do? But no, of course, the devil intervened and came up with a brilliant compromise strategy whereby they said, it's part of the third secret. There are actually two texts to the third secret. And I'm convinced that this was diabolical because it allowed them to accept what they were saying, you know, what they revealed as the third secret, and therefore not accuse John Paul II of having lied about it, and at the same time say that there's more to it about the apostasy and continue to promote their line on Fatima. So it was a brilliant compromise strategy.
And so a fog is created, like basically, you know, what's going on here? I mean, is this part of the third secret? Is John Paul II lying to us? No, it's not the case. It causes just this nebulous situation, this cloudy situation where you just can't find out what's going on. You're just like, who's lying to us? You can't get to the bottom of it. That's the situation that the devil creates with people who don't stand for the truth, that don't tell the truth, that don't cut through the fog and just lay it out. And we know for a fact that John Paul II admitted by Nicholas Gruner and his apostolate, read the third secret. I think it was, what, 1981 maybe around? He read the third secret. So therefore, on May 13th, Saturday, May 13th, when they revealed the third secret, or the interpretation approved of by the phony Sister Lucia of what the third secret was, which the Vatican said was the forces of evil against John Paul II. Okay? And John Paul II was clapping and really happy, and the fake Sister Lucia was cheering on the message. She was really happy. Basically, anyone who would believe this is the real third secret, I mean, it was clear from her, the signs that she was giving, you know, waving her hands and approving of it, that she approved of this interpretation and this phony third secret that the Vatican released. So it's something where someone who knows that John Paul II knew the real third secret because he read it would have to immediately say John Paul II is a total liar. He's now putting out to the public a fake third secret that he knows is a false one.
And what's interesting is that let's examine this claim that there are two texts to the third secret, okay? Gruner's own information and apostolate have promoted that the third secret is one sheet of paper and known to be 20 to 25 lines, okay? The phony third secret that the Vatican released was, I think, 65. Four sheets of paper and 62 lines.
65 lines. Yeah, the one they released on June 26, 2000.
Yeah, so how could it be part of the third secret when it's much longer than the totality of the real third secret? It can't be. It's fundamentally illogical. So this claim that there are two texts is a fraud. But all these false traditionalists have adopted it. And like recently the heretical St. Benedict Center was asked about what their position is on the third secret the Vatican released. And they said, we agree with Fatima scholars that there are two texts. Oh, how convenient. So you don't have to accuse the antipope of a lie. And what's interesting is they published an article, and I want to go through it in more detail in the future because I don't have it here. But there are 10 facts, okay, which they give, which supposedly prove that there are two texts. Well, if you examine all of their facts, they're just – it's fraught with illogical arguments. For instance, they'll say that Cardinal Sodano or the Vatican spokesperson said that John Paul II read the secret on this date. But John Paul II said he read the secret on this date. That proves that there are two texts. No, sorry. That doesn't prove that there are two texts. That just proves that either they're lying or they don't know when he actually read it and they just gave out a date. The fact that they've given out two different dates for when he read the third secret does not by any stretch of the imagination prove that there are two third secrets. And all of the 10 facts are like this, that this, they said that he did this on this date and he said he did it on this date. Therefore, there must be two texts. No, that only proves that there are two texts if you presuppose that they're infallibly telling you the truth. Okay, and so there's no proof that there are two texts at all. It's a joke. And this whole thing was concocted to provide a compromise escape plan for the false traditionalists. And it's really an outrage.
And also the fact that this fake Sister Lucia has fully approved of the Vatican's false interpretation of what the third secret really is. I mean, no honest person could deny that the one who claimed to be Sister Lucia, who recently died, did approve of the Vatican's version of the third secret of Fatima. And that's why, basically, we show, and we have the information on the website, why this so-called Sister Lucia who just died was not the real one. From the photographic evidence, it's very clear-cut. In fact, actually, just recently, in the same issue 3, the Fatima Crusader, they point out, and it was pointed out months ago on other websites, that there's this book that has come out or is about to come out, published or written by Sister Lucia, where she says, quote, talking about World War II, she says that World War II, quote, sought to exterminate Judaism, from which Jesus Christ, the Virgin, and the Apostles came. And she talks about basically that the whole reason, the evil of World War II, was them trying to exterminate Judaism. I mean, think of this.
So
I mean,
she's pro-Jewish, the phony
yeah,
sister.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a joke. It's a complete joke.
And what really irks me is when we get calls or emails or you read these articles by these people who are saying, you know, attacking the fact that there was a counterfeit Sister Lucia, a false Sister Lucia, an imposter Sister Lucia. Meanwhile, these same people actually reject the Vatican's version of the Third Secret of Fatima. They reject what this, quote, Sister Lucia said about John Paul II having successfully consecrated Russia. Okay, so they reject what this, quote, Sister Lucia said. And yet they're attacking the idea that there's an imposter. It's just utterly illogical. It's just, they're so blinded that it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, all the times that she came out and confirmed this is the third secret, you know, I throw away these petitions for the collegial consecration of Russia that are sent out. All the different people that witness her saying that she approves of that the consecration of Russia was done by John Paul II on March 25th, 1984. You know, all these statements basically, well, that wasn't really Sister Lucia. We don't know what she really said. We have to get, you know, her in a meeting, you know, where we can, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, on and on.
You cannot reject the Vatican's false third secret, as almost all who claim to be traditional in any way do, unless you reject the phony Sister Lucia as an imposter. You cannot have it both ways. You cannot say, well, I don't believe that there was an imposter, but yet I reject what the Vatican said about the third secret. You can't have it both ways because she clearly on television endorsed, waved her hands as he was saying, endorsed the Vatican's third secret. No doubt about it. Okay, so
went
none
to
of
the
this
new
nonsense.
Mass, went to the new mass, received invalid, quote, communion. You know, and as soon as she got the host, as we mentioned, she's grabbing John Paul II's hand, kissing it over and over again. You know, the photographic evidence, as we just mentioned, you know, on and on and on. So, and then also the fact that, you know, again, one of the proofs of it being a phony third secret is the fact that we know that the third secret would make more sense in 1960, and they're saying that it deals with the shooting of John Paul II, which took place on May 13th, 1981. So how does that event make more sense in 1960?
Oh, and also relating to this is in one of the Fatima Crusaders, and we've quoted this on our website, Nicholas Gruner was asked whether John Paul II was responsible for having withheld the true third secret, the fullness of the true third secret, because he revealed only, quote, part of it, and whether he held responsibility for this. And Gruner said, no, there must be some other explanation.
There must be some other
explanation. Amazing. That was one of the most dishonest statements I've ever read from a false traditionalist.
But the fact that he's not attacking left, right, and center, if he really stands for the truth, there's something that's blocking him, okay, obviously, through his own fault, from telling the full truth on John Paul II's apostasy when he was anti-pope, about Benedict XVI. I mean, you know, he knows about their activities, so why isn't he informing the people about them? He's telling the people about EWTN.
Yeah, and we have an article on, as to our opinion, why they're really interested in that on our website. But what's interesting is, getting back to the deceptive tactics of the anti-popes, is that John Paul II would do some of this stuff that Ratzinger does too, make certain conservative statements deliberately. Not as often, I don't think, because some of his actions were so notorious that you know, he was just full speed ahead with promotion of religious indifferentism. That some of the one false traditionalist author actually mentioned in his book and in his talks about how John Paul II, when he would get near Fatima, would start to say some more conservative things. He called it the Fatima Zone. This same author said that John Paul II makes statements that no one's in hell, basically implying universal salvation, but when he gets near Fatima, he seemed to talk about souls going to hell. Well, what he doesn't realize is that the only reason he made a statement like that is because he recognized, John Paul II, that around Fatima you were dealing with more conservative-minded individuals. And so he might make a statement here or there that is more conservative in order to tailor his false message to that audience.
To bring you in, to sort of stop you from saying, yeah, this guy's totally evil. He throws out these conservative statements because they're enough for most bad-willed people to get them back accepting him. Well, you know, he made this statement that one year about souls going to hell, even though 98% of all the other stuff's total apostasy. He throws that one statement out there as bait, and the people bite on it.
And this person was baffled. He was like, I call it the Fatima Zone, because, you know, it seems that everything seems to come back when he goes to Fatima, you know, the four last things, hell, judgment. That's right, because he's just trying to lure heretics in.
To try to confirm people that he's a true pope. You know, he's not a heretic. You know, we still have a legitimate pope. That's the message that's trying to be reinforced in people's minds. And so you have that kind of stuff going on. I think also maybe we can quickly mention really what the truth of the consecration of Russia, you know, is.
Oh, yeah. We have that long article on our website, which gets into the context of what Our Lady actually meant. And we originally believed, as pretty much everyone else did, that when Our Lady said, in the end, my Immaculate Heart will triumph, the Holy Father will consecrate Russia to me, and it will be converted, and a certain period of peace will be granted to the world, that meant that Russia would be converted to the Catholic faith, that Our Lady was promising that. And that was what I thought was the case. But when I investigated it more and studied the three-volume set, The Whole Truth About Fatima, for Michel, looking for any evidence that Our Lady actually promised the conversion of Russia to the Catholic faith, I saw that there isn't any evidence at all for that. And actually, if you look at other statements Sister Lucy made, she describes the effects of the conversion of Russia as the ending of the persecution. Okay, she describes it as
a shortening of the time.
Yeah, His Holiness will obtain an abbreviation of these days of tribulation if he takes heed of my wishes by promulgating the act of consecration. That's what she said. That's what our Lord said, actually, to Sister Lucy, 1940. And actually, people say, well, no, she never used the word conversion. you know, and we've taken some attacks for this, and other people who can perceive it agree. But in Proverbs 16:17, we see that God himself uses the word conversion not to mean necessarily conversion to the true faith, but a conversion of an enemy to peace, to a certain peace. Proverbs 16:7 says, "When the ways of man shall please the Lord, he will convert even his enemies to peace." And actually, if you look at and compare that to what Our Lady said in the July 13th message, it's very similar. She says, "If they listen to my requests, Russia will be converted and there will be peace." So it's very, very similar. And actually, if you analyze what Our Lady was saying in July 13th, she's talking in the context of the ending of Russia's particular things. She says, "When you see a night illuminated by an unknown light, know that it is a great sign that God gives you that he's going to punish the world for its crimes by means of war, of hunger, and of persecution of the church and of the Holy Father. To prevent this, I come to ask the consecration of Russia." She's saying to prevent the crimes of war, of hunger, and of persecution. That is strong evidence.
And you can see in the article, you know, the famines that took place, like the in the Ukraine right after, you know, and the other persecutions and wars that took place.
Yeah, her words are strong, total evidence, really strong evidence that she's referring to the effects of the consecration being the stopping of these wars, hunger, and persecution stirred up by Russia. And we see, as we examine in detail in this article, about how Russia did those very things. It started famines and wars. Now, let me make it clear. Our Lady would desire the conversion of the whole nation of Russia to the Catholic faith, but she's not necessarily promising that. She doesn't say that. And so this whole idea that Russia will be converted to the Catholic faith has been built up and used, and really it's an error.
And in the original message, when she's talking about the consecration of Russia, right, she talks about peace in the first time. "If my requests are heeded, peace will be given." And then she talks about in the end and a certain period of peace.
Yep, that's right. That's a point that's almost, until this article is published, not mentioned at all. And it's really a key point.
So if they perfectly fulfilled originally what she wanted to be done, yeah, maybe there would be a different kind of peace given, you know. But since they didn't do it, or they did it at the end and it was later than it should have been done, you know, a certain period of peace was given.
Yeah, she says, "If they listen to my requests, Russia will be converted and there will be peace." Okay, so she's saying if my requests are fulfilled, there will be peace. But then when she repeats it, she says, "In the end, my Immaculate Heart will triumph. The Holy Father will consecrate Russia to me, and it will be converted, and a certain period of peace." Well, why the certain? Why has certain been added when she said, "If my requests are heeded, there will simply be peace"? The addition of certain implies that the requests were not heeded exactly as she wanted. And we know that because when Pius XII, actually, for those who are new, I should probably mention this, Pius XII actually consecrated Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary on July 7th, 1952. That's a fact. No one can deny it. He said specifically in his letter Sacro Virginiti Anno, "Just as a few years ago we consecrated the entire human race to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, so today we consecrate, and in a most special manner we entrust all the peoples of Russia to the Immaculate Heart." So he consecrated Russia in 1952. Now people say, well, Our Lady requested that it would be done with all the bishops. That's right. She requested that it would be done with all the bishops. She never promised that it would be done with all the bishops. She promised that in the end, the Holy Father will consecrate Russia to me and a certain period of peace. That implies that the certain period of peace, as opposed to the just peace, was given because it wasn't done with all the bishops.
And she says, she doesn't say the Holy Father will do it with all the bishops in the end.
No.
She says the Holy Father will do it.
That's
so
right.
These people say, well, no, it can't be done, and we can't have this period of peace until it's done with all the bishops. Well, what does Our Lady say? She says that in the end, the Holy Father will do it. Why wouldn't she add or have added, "And the Holy Father will consecrate with all the bishops Russia to my Immaculate Heart"? She doesn't say that.
I'm totally convinced that this is the true understanding of Our Lady's words. The context of her message is really clear, where she says, to prevent this, referring to war, persecution, hunger, the fact that convert is used in a very similar way by God himself, not to mean a conversion to the true faith, but a conversion of an enemy to peace.
And we have the country of Portugal when the bishops did the consecration of that country.
There was
the Immaculate Heart that the...
Well, yeah, people try to say that that proves...
The showcase of Our Lady.
Yeah, they like certain say, well, you know, there's a tremendous Catholic revival and, you know, increase in vocations. But Portugal didn't even become a Catholic country when the bishops consecrated Portugal to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And they're saying this is, you know, the showcase of Our Lady. The
Constitution didn't change, right?
Yeah, the Catholic religion is not recognized as the official religion of the Portuguese state in that after that, no. And then, like we said, this is...
And Sister Lucie actually said that, you know, the fruits that they, you know, reaped from that consecration would be gained if the Pope would do the consecration of Russia. So, therefore, I mean, you didn't have a total universal restoration, you know, or, you know, the Catholic faith coming back totally in that whole country.
Yeah, you didn't have the country becoming Catholic. And also... It's interesting to note, I think I should quote here. This is from The Whole Truth About Fatima, Volume 2, page 465. Sister Lucy says, referring to the effects of the consecration, the good Lord promises to end the persecution in Russia if the Holy Father will himself make a solemn act of reparation and consecration of Russia. That's what she says. That's the effect of the consecration of Russia. And people diminish that. They say, oh, that couldn't be good enough. Well, that's why we spend some pages dealing with how horrible the situation was in Russia and in the countries when this persecution was going on.
Yeah, and we should say revival. I mentioned a restoration. I mean, the church doesn't need to be restored, but there would be, you know, obviously revival on some level.
Yeah, and so that's covered in detail in that article on our website. But I think it's also worth... We're talking about those people who, you know, hang on to the Vatican II anti-popes while rejecting, you know, the new church in many ways and calling it a counter-church, like the false traditionalist SSPX. I think we should quote some of the things that the Society of St. Pius X has said about the counter-church. This is from, here, I'm looking here. Oh, here it is. This is what Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre said on August 2nd, 1976. He says, speaking of the Novus Ordo Church, all those enter into schism who cooperate in this realization of this upheaval and adhere to this new conciliar church. So he said that the Vatican II Church was a new church into which people enter into schism if they are part of it. Father Franz Schmidberger of the Society of St. Pius X says, quote, we have never wished to belong to this system which calls itself the conciliar church and identifies itself with the Novus Ordo Missae. The faithful indeed have a right to know that priests who serve them are not in communion with a counterfeit church. So he's saying that...
Yeah, they're not in communion with a counterfeit church. And who's the head of the counterfeit church? And you can't not be in communion with the head of the Catholic Church. And they believe these guys were legitimate popes. And Pope Leo XIII points out in Satis Cognitum that there is a unity of communion by divine law of the people with the Pope by divine law. You can't have a situation where your faith and government aren't the same as a true Roman pontiff.
Yeah, one of the marks of the unity of the church is a unity of communion. Okay, so if he's not in communion with the counterfeit church, referring to the Vatican II church, that means he's not in communion with the head of the counterfeit church.
And we quoted before also Pope Pius XII in Mystici Corporis Christi, his encyclical of June 29, 1943, where he says, those who are divided in faith or in government are not living in the unity of the same church.
And so it's like saying I refuse communion with the Communist Party, but I don't refuse communion with the head of the Communist Party. It's just ridiculous, and they need to come to the realization.
And the head of the Communist Party enjoys legitimate authority. We accept his authority. The head of the Communist Party, he's a legitimate ruler. He has valid authority.
And there's another quote from the Angelus, May 2000. This current renewal has given birth to a new church within the bosom of the Catholic Church, that which Monsignor Benelli called the Conciliar Church. It is against this Conciliar Church that our resistance stands. We do not refuse our adherence to the Pope as such, but to this conciliar church. So again, This is completely illogical. And the definition of schism is to refuse communion with a true pope or with the members of the church subject to the true pope. So if they say we're not in communion with his whole church, but we're in communion with John Paul II or Benedict XVI, that's schism. They're saying that we're not in communion with the members of the church subject to the one they think is the pope. And that's why their position, and it's not just the Society of St. Pius X. The reason we're focusing on this is because so many different groups hold a similar type of position. You've got the Father Wathen type of position, which is a similar scenario.
And also, going back to Lefebvre, if you look at his statements, which maybe in the future we'll discuss, you know, he didn't have this idea of the position of sedevacantism, that we have no pope, as an illogical or unreasonable or ridiculous position. Quite to the contrary, he actually, and it was covered actually in the Angelus magazine, I believe, in March of 1986, where he talks about John Paul II's upcoming Assisi prayer meeting, which was held on October 27th, 1986. And he talks about how that, you know, we may have to say after this upcoming Assisi prayer meeting where John Paul II is going to meet with all the different religions and pray with them, we may have to say that we have no pope. He said that I don't wish to formally and solemnly teach and state that he's not pope. He says, but it seems impossible to me to see how a person can be a pope and a public heretic at the same time.
Yeah, we were going to take a call now. John?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. Brother, I have a question. I just read a book, The Destruction of the Christian Tradition, by Rama Kumaraswamy, who recently actually passed away in July. And now I understand what's going on, and I've been going to a Latin Mass. But I'm also the president of the Holy Name Society in my local parish. I haven't been going to the new Mass there, but I was wondering if I should stay on as president. I have about 9 months to go to run the meetings and stuff, or you think I should resign now?
Yeah, you should definitely resign. And it sounds like you may be going to an indult Mass. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
In the book, it mentioned an indult, but they don't make me sign anything when
yeah.
I go to this Mass.
Well, the problem is that the priests, if they were ordained after 1968...
Right, that's what the book said. Yeah.
Is the priest you're going to...
He seems pretty old. I mean, I don't know his age.
Yeah.
He's definitely over 55, I know that.
Well, see, it's something where June 18th, 1968 was when Paul VI signed the change in. And sometimes they do have some really old priests because they're the only ones that remember how to celebrate the Latin Mass,
right.
Offer the indult Mass. But then you also have the problem that, you know, it's celebrated in a church where they're celebrating the Novus Ordo.
You have the altar.
It's done on the second altar many times. You have, even when the people go up for a communion, the priest may turn around, go into the tabernacle, and pull out unconsecrated Novus Ordo hosts and give them to the people. And then also the possibility at some of the places they actually make you sign something. And so, a lot of problems. So that's why we, like, almost would never recommend it.
Yeah, and so we would say if you contact us maybe, you know, during the week or after the program or something, we could, you know, maybe recommend a better option for you.
Yeah, there's probably some better options out there, you know, either independent Latin Masses or a Byzantine Rite possibly.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I'm in the Diocese of Metuchen, but this Mass is located in the Diocese of Trenton. And they also mentioned that they were going on pilgrimage to Our Lady of Chestawa in Pennsylvania, and that the Cardinal Regali in Philadelphia told them they could do the traditional Mass on pilgrimage.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to go on pilgrimage with them because they're basically promoters of the Vatican II religion.
I mean, what you could try to do before you leave is try to contact them, maybe give, you know, different members a call. And I would just say, you know, recommend our website and, you know, our information because, you know, they can take a look and watch the videos for free online on the website and, you know, and then it's really up to them. I mean, it's a person's choice at that point in time. Once you see the information on the new Mass, this apostasy and everything, it's really up to them what they want to do at that point in time.
What I was also wondering is if my pastor
if I ask him to say the Holy Name Mass, because it's once a month we have a Holy Name Mass, if he would say it as a Latin Mass, would that be okay or no?
Well, like we said, he may not even be validly ordained, and so I wouldn't recommend that.
Yeah.
But I would try to give them the information, you know, recommend, like, our website, you know, the information, try to, you know, inform them on the changes to the Mass and the apostasy that we're talking about, you know, because obviously you want to try to help these people,
right,
you know, save their souls, too. It's a sad situation, but, you know.
And you don't think it's going to be any time soon that they'll make the Latin Mass more, you know, allow it more in every parish? You don't think it's going to happen anytime soon?
Well, it's possible, but it's something where I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, you heard at the beginning when Joseph Ratzinger, now Benedict XVI, came into his office as antipope, you know, the people were saying he'll immediately release, you know, and make more available the Latin Mass to people, which, you know, didn't happen, hasn't happened so far. It might possibly happen to a certain extent down the line. But I think people need to realize that, you know, a lot of people that are going to Latin Masses, they may like the Latin Mass more, but most of the people that are going to Latin Masses deny fundamental teachings of the Catholic Church, such as outside the Church there is no salvation.
Right.
A lot of the people that we talk to that go to Latin Masses across the country, you ask them, do you believe you have to be a Catholic to be saved? Well, no, if you're a good person and, you know, you hear these kinds of responses, you know, and you practice your religion and you believe it's true or never heard of the gospel and were never baptized, that God will still allow you to go to heaven. You know, that's what these people are saying. I mean, and it's just about probably 100% of people that even go to Latin Masses. So it's something where the faith is above the Mass itself.
Yeah, and so even if they give the Benedict XVI were to give the Latin Mass out more widely, it would only be to neutralize the people who are opposed to the heresies. And also, it wouldn't make a difference in most cases because the priests would be have been ordained in the new rite of ordination and therefore not, you know, validly ordained priests. And also, if it causes them to come into a compromise and an acceptance of Vatican II, this apostate council, or not condemn the apostate bishops and or Benedict XVI, then it's not going to profit them unto salvation.
And see, the effect on some level is going to be that they're going to either accept Vatican II or, you know, some of the things in Vatican II, and they're not going to be able to criticize Benedict XVI, as you can see at some of these indult masses where, you know, the priests that are offering the masses, actually I had heard years ago that actually priests that offer the indult masses, that there would be a diocesan representative that would be at the mass that would actually be taking notes of what the priest at the indult mass was saying. And if he said anything that was, you know, objectionable, you know, basically he's in trouble. So basically you have to zip your mouth shut. It's just like many Byzantine Rite priests who we've spoken to. I mean, you cannot criticize anything that's going on. You'll either be booted out by the board of the church or the people there. And see, what happens is once you start to criticize some of the things that are going on, once you decide to take that stand, that I'm going to criticize this. I don't like what this statement by Benedict XVI. I don't like this abuse. I disagree with that statement. As soon as you do that, you know, you're going to logically start denouncing more and more stuff. The people are going to get angry, you know, because you're now starting to upset some people. You're attacking the person who claims to be Pope, and you're going to be out. It's just that simple.
So yeah, it's something you'd want to, you know, extricate yourself from and really, you know, not be involved with.
Well, I stopped going to the Holy Name Mass, you know, because we have that once a month. So I haven't showed up to that. But I figured I was obligated at least to run the meetings. So I've been doing the meetings.
Yeah, you couldn't do it. You should inform them of, you know, like you said, our website. We have really incredible offers for extra copies of things you can get really for very cheap prices or even an order form. You know, but once you've informed them of that, you should just, you know, break from that, because they're promoters of salvation outside the church. These people don't, unfortunately, accept the traditional teachings of the church and
religious indifferentism.
It's rampant.
You know, Vatican II. And also going to an invalid mass.
Yeah, and the priest may not even be validly ordained.
Right. I did mention to the pastor of this other parish that is doing the Latin Mass, about the book I read and how they brought in the Protestant consultants. And what he told me, he says, you know, it was all true, what I read, and that he kind of said that Paul VI was like had that these Protestant observers said if he changed the Mass to please them, they'd convert, which never happened.
Well, that's not true.
Yeah, he's saying that he thinks that slowly we will go back, you know, to the traditional Catholic Church, but it's going to take time. And he said, you know, we talked about the words of consecration, how they changed all, many to all, and he's saying that a new translation is supposed to be coming out in a couple of years.
Yeah, that's what they're always saying, you know.
Yeah,
and they're always talking about this new translation is going to come out. It's going to clean up all the bad activity.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It doesn't happen. It's something.
But I will say, brother, that the Mass I have been attending does look legitimate from what I've read in the book that it should be doing. everything does seem legitimate, you know, the way they carry it out.
Well, I mean, but you have to make sure, you know, that you're dealing with a validly ordained priest. There's some high Anglican services that seem like the real legitimate Latin Tridentine Mass, but, you know,
right,
it's not even
right.
Catholic.
And with these indult parishes, like, often it's the case that they're so notorious that you shouldn't go at all, even if it, you know, were valid and there was nothing going on with the Novus Ordo directly in the Mass. And also the fact that, you know, you could never give them any money at all. That needs to be emphasized as well. But we really feel that, you know, you should, if you contact us, we can maybe recommend something better for you.
Yeah, but even these priests, I mean, like, someone has to really ask them the question. You can look at Matthew 26:28, Christ's words of institution for the sacrament of the Eucharist. He uses many.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know,
yes.
And they over and over again are repeating when they say the new Mass, all. I mean, how that doesn't strike them as being problematic. I mean, it's just, you know, it's something where, and see also him saying that Paul VI is going to try to convert these people, you know, if he changed the Mass or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can't just go by that. I've had other Byzantine Rite priests that have told me when I've brought up things about what John Paul II did, you know, I don't believe he really said that. And, you know, they're trying to convert these people to Catholic faith. I mean, it's something where they don't care to check into these issues and find out what's really going on. All it takes is a cursory study of these issues to find out that they explicitly do not want to convert these people to the Catholic faith.
Yeah. So.
Also, brother, in the book it says if you can't find a Latin Mass, then on Sundays say the Rosary or read the Missal. This author was saying.
Yeah, that there's no obligation to go to the Mass of a heretic, even if it's valid and everything's being done properly with regard to the Mass. And in this situation, you know, you could just stay home and, you know, sanctify the Sunday by praying your rosary.
And we would also say that there are some priests that offer Latin Masses or Byzantine Rite liturgies, and, I mean, they may say something that's so notoriously heretical that, you know, you may have to leave and try to find some other place to go. Or if they know that you don't believe, say, Benedict XVI is a valid pope, or you think he's a heretic, and they say anyone who thinks that Benedict XVI is not a valid pope or a heretic is not welcome here, we don't want you here, or if you believe only baptized Catholics can be saved, we don't want you here, leave, get out, we don't agree with that, we think you're a heretic,
right?
You know, then it would also be time to leave.
Right. So. All right. Thank you very much, brother. I appreciate my phone call.
No problem.
Okay, thanks. So I think it's worth mentioning also, I don't know if we quoted, switching back to Benedict XVI. Hold on one sec. Yeah, switching back to Benedict XVI, I don't know if we quoted his particular denial of the papacy, and we'll get to that, but right now we're going to take a caller. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Dorothy from Texas. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, you're on.
Yes, well, hi, I'm Dorothy Clark, and I was going to ask if you knew of Archbishop Lefebvre being ordained by a Mason.
Yes.
And I've heard that, you know, about the sacrament, you have to have form, matter, and intent, and a Mason would not have the intent for him to become a priest, and then he wouldn't be ordained a priest. And then could he become a bishop without being a priest?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thanks for the question. we can, we're pretty familiar with that issue. We've looked into it.
Okay.
And the answer is that what she's referring to is Cardinal Leonhard ordained Archbishop Lefebvre, a priest, and he also consecrated him a bishop with two other co-consecrators later on. And Cardinal Leonhard was one of the most radical heretics at Vatican II, and he was rumored to have been a Freemason, although there's no total proof of that. And so some people say that since he was a Freemason and ordained Archbishop Lefebvre, he could not have had the intention to ordain him, and therefore Lefebvre was not a validly ordained priest, could not have been a valid bishop. All the priests of the Lefebvre line are therefore invalid. And the answer to that is that Pope Leo XIII teaches in Apostolici Curiae that when a sacrament is conferred and the outward external rite is adhered to, the intention is presumed, okay? And he says, when a minister uses the correct form in conferring the sacrament, he is presumed for that very reason to have intended to do what the Church does, because you can't read his mind. So that's why the Church, since Leonhard used the traditional rite in ordaining Lefebvre, he is presumed to have had the intention to ordain Lefebvre. And there's no written statement from Leonhard saying that he positively did not have the intention to ordain Lefebvre. And that's why the Church presumes validity in that case, unless you had like a written statement from Leonhard saying that he specifically withheld his intention. And so it would have to be considered valid. And if not, because there are other allegations of Freemasons, for instance, Cardinal Rampolla, who was the Secretary of State under Pope Leo XIII, he was discovered after his death to have been a Freemason.
They say by Pius X, actually, discovered it on his person, that he was a 33rd degree Freemason.
Yeah, and so...
Who did he consecrate?
Yeah,
who did he ordain? So that's why the Church says when a minister uses the form, the traditional form that the Church prescribes for a sacrament, he is for that very reason presumed to have the intention of doing what the Church does. Now, the only other kind of intention would be an internal intention, even if he used the traditional rite and said in his heart, I do not intend to ordain this man to the priesthood. Well, then it would not be valid. But the only way that someone would ever discover that is if he wrote a note, as he was saying, and something came out where they told someone, you know, that I actually had a positive internal intention not to ordain that guy or those people to the priesthood. That's the only way you would know. Otherwise, you have to go by whether he uses the traditional rite and form. And
So it can't be considered invalid. And I know a lot of people have been confused about that and struggled with it. And but if you could consider that doubtful or invalid, then there's so many. You could go back and find all kinds of cases in history, and it would be just chaos.
Yeah.
So that's why it would have to be considered valid.
Okay, well, I just heard that Archbishop Book volunteered to conditionally, I think it was consecrate him as a bishop, because he thought that it wasn't
valid. Yeah.
And he denied it.
Yeah, Tuck thought it was, he thought that Lefebvre should undergo conditional ordination and
to remove the doubt.
Yeah, and Lefebvre even said... that he saw a picture of Leonhard in his Masonic regalia when actually he was mistaken. Leonhard was not in his Masonic regalia.
He gave a speech in Montreal in which he thought he had seen Leonhard dressed up in Masonic attire and actually was mistaken.
But even though Tux thought that, he was just simply not correct about that. And you'd have to consider it valid.
And it's the same thing with Tuck. There are people that are questioning the Tuck line ordination and consecration. And the same thing goes there, that, you know, Tuck used the traditional rite, you know, and therefore it's valid.
Yeah. Also, like, people even allege that Pius IX, I mean, like, certain people have falsely accused Pius IX of having been a Freemason. Okay, obviously, I don't believe that's true at all, but... You know, you could make allegations, and therefore we'd have to say, you know, there's a doubt in that line and a doubt here, and so that's why it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and God, you know, obviously being an all-merciful God, he's not going to allow that kind of chaos to go on.
Yeah. So thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks. One other point relating to that is that one of the reasons that people have come to believe that the Society of St. Pius X priests are invalid is because they have sort of functioned and acted as and been used as a counter, like,
resistance. Yeah.
That basically, like, they've, you know, brought to themselves many traditional-minded people who are opposed to the apostasy, and they've neutralized them by bringing them into this illogical position and with other heresies, and they say that that's because their priests are not really priests, and it's all a master counter-church of the devil, you know, to neutralize the traditionalists. And even though the Society of St. Pius X has been used in that sense, no doubt, because their positions are so illogical and heretical and on salvation, which we may discuss here soon, as we've discussed in the past, quite evil, they've also been an avenue by which many have come to a knowledge of the true Catholic faith. And they do many good things. And so if people don't fall into their heresies, which aren't necessarily promoted by all the priests, you know, publicly, they could come in contact with the true faith. So,
yeah, I mean, there are a lot of stories. I mean, how many stories do you have someone coming to the knowledge, as you were just saying, of the true faith, the true Mass, some of the changes, the problems with the modernism and what these so-called popes are doing through even a Society of Pius X church and even their literature, while it may have, and it does have, you know, some problems in the material that they produce and promote and disseminate. You know, there is a lot of good information in there to make people realize that there's some major problems going on.
But the farther we go along here, the worse their positions become, because it becomes more and more apparent, you know, to everyone who's thinking correctly that, you know, you must completely reject the false church. And the longer they maintain this untenable position, the more and more faith-destroying their schismatic position becomes. But so we don't believe that they're used by the devil to neutralize certain traditionalists, and also used by God to make people aware of what's going on, requires that one believe that they don't have valid priests, that they can be just valid priests and liberals, and so it doesn't require that.
Yeah, and see, and also a lot of people have to get out of the fog that they're in that are going to the Society of Pius X also, though, because, you know, we tell people, do you know that they sell books that say Buddhists and animists and Hindus can be saved? And this actually is something that Archbishop Lefebvre said that's promoted in their books, some of their best-selling books. And they're like, oh, no, not my priest. They don't say that. I know that for a fact. Oh, really?
Yeah, it's only all over, some of their bestsellers.
People need to wake up and realize this. They have that major problem. They believe souls and other different religions can be saved. You won't probably hear it from the pulpit
much,
thankfully, but it is promoted in their books. They promote natural family planning. They promote that these anti-popes and these apostate bishops are actually Catholics but just have problems and have errors. And actually, even while they don't like the new Mass, they even accept the new Mass as being valid. So, you know, that is a major problem. You know, again, that, you know, they've seen the arguments that show how you have to have, you can't change the words that Jesus Christ specifically instituted for a sacrament of the church, like the Eucharist. And they think that using all there doesn't, you know, invalidate the sacrament. And they're obviously wrong to believe that. So, you know, that's why people, unfortunately, can't support them financially. Yes, they do many good things with the retreats and the camps that they run and the schools and, you know, the way some of them offer the Mass, the way it seems, you know, traditional and so forth and edifying. But people need to look at these issues of the faith also to realize that you've got to not only be offering the right Mass and administering valid sacraments and doing some nice, good things in a traditional way, you also have to hold fast to the dogmatic teachings of the church. And we got another email asking about, from Steve, asking about any thoughts on Padre Pio's belief in Garibandal. What do you make of it? Well, actually, some people have believed that Padre Pio approved of Garibandal based upon the fact that the veil that covered his face was given to Conchita, one of the claimed seers of Our Lady at Garibandal. That actually veil was not given, apparently, by Padre Pio. It was given by one of the good friends that was a priest of Padre Pio who got the veil, he sent it to Conchita. So it wasn't directly sent by Padre Pio. And I actually have called the National Center for Padre Pio and asked them, is there any information that indicates that Padre Pio approved of Garabandal? And they say there's no evidence for it, and you won't find it in any of the books that I've read.
And we don't believe in Garabandal, that it was a true a message from heaven for a number of reasons. The vision occurred when the children were stealing apples. They walked backwards at the vision. That's not a main point, but that's an interesting consideration. They said in the message, supposedly from heaven, that the Pope, referring to Paul VI, will reconvene the council, and it will be a great event in the church, referring to Vatican II. And that, of course, would be totally false.
They also say that apparently, I don't know if it was directly said by Our Lady, but one of the seers, maybe it was Conchita, said that there will be three more popes after John the 23rd, and we'll get the great chastisement. Well, that takes you to John Paul II. So it totally contradicts what she said.
Yeah.
Totally contradicts it. And then also you also had the so-called Eucharistic miracle that was predicted to happen on a certain day, and it happens the following day, the following morning, on the following day. And that's not the way God works. And if God says that the miracle is going to be performed on a certain day, it happens on that day, just like the miracle at Fatima happened on October 13th, just as Our Lady said it would happen. And then also you have the fact that all these supposed seers, none of them went into religious life. They all go to the post-Vatican II masses and follow the changes. And while that's not the total, you know, litmus test for whether they're authentic, it's something that there are a lot of things that are problematic. And also the fact that they're talking about the main thing that's going to happen in the future is the great miracle, the great warning, the miracle, and then the chastisement if mankind doesn't amend. Well, I mean, at that time of the Garabandal apparitions, you know, you had all these changes at Vatican II that were about to change the entire faith or attempt to change the entire faith. You had this new mass coming out that was going to be an invalid mass, other false sacraments that were invalid coming out. If Our Lady was truly appearing and wanting to warn people about something, she would have told them about all these different changes to the sacraments, the faith being obliterated, because that's worse than the earth being hit by a comet. So there are just a lot of these different apparitions that have recently sprung up. You know, it's all about a great physical chastisement that, yeah, you're it's going to come, this great chastisement. It's going to be the ball of redemption, World War III, comet, the warning, the miracle. Nothing about the faith being obliterated, the mass being obliterated, and the sacraments being changed and invalidated.
Yeah, and I don't know if we quoted in the last program, Benedict XVI's denial of the papal primacy. Maybe just close it off with that. We did cover, I know, that he says that Protestants don't have to believe in the papal primacy. But I think, in case we didn't mention it, it's important to point out, Vatican I defines as a dogma that a pope has supreme jurisdiction over the universal church. That's a dogma at Vatican I. And that is rejected by the Orthodox, quote, schismatics, who hold that, you know, he's the first among equals. He doesn't have supreme jurisdiction. And in his book, Principles of Catholic Theology, Ratzinger says on page 198 to 199, he goes, in other words, Rome must not require more from the East, meaning the Orthodox, with respect to the doctrine of the primacy than it had been formulated and was lived in the first millennium. When the Patriarch Athenagoras, he's talking about the schismatic patriarch, on the occasion of Paul VI's visit to Phanar, designated him as the successor of St. Peter, as the most esteemed among us, as one who presides in charity. This great church leader was expressing the ecclesial content of the doctrine of the primacy as was known in the first millennium. Rome need not ask for more. So in other words, Rome doesn't have to ask the schismatic patriarch to accept the primacy of supreme jurisdiction. All it has to ask him to acknowledge is that the Pope is the successor of St. Peter, the most esteemed among us. Well, many Orthodox schismatics say that a Pope a bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter. He's the first among equals. But they say he doesn't have supreme jurisdiction. Ratzinger's saying it's fine that they don't say he doesn't have supreme jurisdiction. But the quote I really wanted to mention was this one on page 216 to 217, where Ratzinger says, Benedict XVI, Patriarch Athenagoras, the schismatic patriarch, spoke even more strongly when he greeted Paul VI in Phanar. He said, the bishop of Rome is among us, the first among us in honor. This is what many Orthodox say. He who presides in love. And Ratzinger comments, it is clear that in saying this, the patriarch, the schismatic patriarch, did not abandon the claims of the Eastern churches or acknowledge the primacy of the West. Rather, he stated plainly what the East understood as the order, the rank, and title of the equal bishops in the church. And it would be worth our while to consider whether this archaic confession, which has nothing to do with the primacy of jurisdiction but confesses a primacy of honor and love, might not be recognized as a formula that adequately reflects the position that Rome occupies in the church. So he's saying that this formula of the schismatic, which simply says he's the first among equals, and has nothing to do, says Ratzinger, with a primacy of jurisdiction, but merely a primacy of honor, exactly what the Orthodox position is, he's saying it's worthwhile to consider whether this might be recognized as a formula that adequately reflects the position that Rome occupies, in other words, the Bishop of Rome. In other words, he not only says, to sum it up, that the Eastern schismatics don't have to believe in the papacy, he's saying here that their position on the papacy might be true. And that, of course, is directly anathematized by Vatican I.
And so stay tuned. Check out the website to see when our next program will be, maybe possibly next Saturday. And stay tuned for details. Thank you.